right, y'all, welcome back to the show. Santa War Radio, Chaos 95.9 FM in Austin, Texas. Streaming live worldwide on the internet at chaosradioaustin.org and at antiwar.com/radio. And our next guest on the show is the great Sheldon Richman from the Future of Freedom Foundation. He's the editor of The Freeman, and he keeps the blog sheldonfreeassociation.blogspot.com. And I think last time we talked, you told me there's an easier way to get there. Welcome to the show. How's it going?
Hey, I'm doing great. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thanks for joining us. And what is the easier way to get to your blog there?
SheldonRichman.com.
SheldonRichman.com. That's a lot easier than .blogspot, this, that,
yeah,
and
that blogspot nonsense.
Yeah. All right. Well, anyway, so thanks for joining us on the show. And, well...
Always a pleasure.
Oh, great. So here's the thing. Basically, what we cover on the show, you know, day in and day out here, is the lawlessness, ultimately, of the national government. Well, the immorality, ultimately. But in practice, the lawlessness of the government of the United States. And... their widespread persecution, torture, kidnapping, disappearances and murders, and aggressive warfare across the world, the global battlefield, as your associate Jacob Hornberger was just describing on the show a little while ago. And so I was kind of thinking maybe I'd let you come on here and make the case for maybe we should just abolish this state, and particularly the warfare state. And, well, for example... Could you make the case, I bet you could, that America's been at war pretty much since 1791 and that there's really no such thing as national defense at all. There's only aggression, at least in this country.
Yeah, I don't think it's continuous since 1791. That may be a stretch. You know, there was more of an interest in keeping America at home in the earlier days. You know, things pick up, of course, with McKinley and the Spanish-American War. And then we become a Pacific power. You know, you can find bits here and there. But, yeah, I don't, you know, we don't want to put too fine a point on it. Well, true. Okay, I was thinking more traditional sorts of wars, but good point. Yeah, there's a lot of nasty stuff that has gone on. I had occasion to think of this recently when, with the passing of Howard Zinn, prompted me to... take a look at the first couple chapters of his People's History, and he goes through some of that interesting stuff. So, yeah. So the question is, what you talked about the lawlessness, but of course, you know, if we take the Nixon doctrine seriously, one of the Nixon doctrines, if the president does something, it's got to be legal. So, government lawlessness is a contradiction in terms, according to some people. Is that right? And that.
Yeah, I mean, that's basically the thing. Well, we just ended the last interview with a prosecutor who himself was prosecuted, an unprecedented event, for framing up these guys on terrorism charges. Well, one of them tried to sue him, and the court said, nah, you can't sue him. He's got sovereign immunity. He can frame up whoever he wants. That's just the least example, right?
Right. Well, yeah, there's good old sovereign immunity. They got other rabbits in the hat, too, I guess, but that's a good standby. You can't sue me unless I give you permission to. That's a good deal.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a great one.
All right, so that's consistent, really, if you think about it, with the doctrine of what the state is. I mean, the state is not just another organization in society. It's super special. So it's sort of consistent that the view of a good state defender is that what it does is not, can't be against the law by definition. I mean, there have been many attempts over the years to subject government to law, but, you know, always found these ways around it or doctrines that give it exceptions. And
yeah. Well, you know, yeah, like Tom Woods said, you probably couldn't have had a better experiment in minarchy than America. And yet, look at us now. The biggest government ever, times 100.
Well, what always astounds me is when you look back at certain people who critics of the American political system. Very early on, I'm thinking of John Taylor of Caroline. You know, he's writing in the first decade of the 1800s. Okay, the ink is still wet on the Constitution. Am I right? You know, like 1804 7 or something, right?
Yeah, Jefferson administration or something.
Yeah, it's pretty early. He's complaining about big government and how the federal government has already violated the boundaries that Madison and Hamilton insisted were there in the Constitution. It's all, you know, the Congress has already gone beyond the limits we were told it would go. I mean, he's complaining in prior to 1810. And then, you know, you can find similar things in the late 19th century, you know, which is sometimes thought of as, even by libertarians, as the golden era, right? Once slavery is gone, we're often told that there's a golden era from 1870 to the progressive era, or maybe a little earlier, let's say 1870 to the progressive era, the turn of the century, was kind of the time. Not perfect, I would say, but darn close. And yet, look what Lysander Spooner and Benjamin Tucker and those guys were saying back then. They were complaining about the money monopoly, the patent monopoly, the tariff, all the ways that big business, essentially, was gaining power through the government.
Yeah, and Gilded Age. Hey, you know, one time I read my horoscope in The Onion, and it said, today you will realize that the nation state with a monopoly on forest based on the theory of protecting you from an endless series of scary foreign threats is no longer tenable, and that we're going to have to find a better way, or something like that. So, well, what about that? I mean, if I had my wish and I could just sink Washington, D.C. and all the statues and everything into the ocean, and we just didn't have a national government anymore, or even the state governments, and we had some kind of private property anarchy, wouldn't we be helpless against attack from the Canadians? I mean, that's why you absolutely have to have a state,
we're
right? Is because or else another one will come and replace it, and it'll be even worse than this one.
Well, no. See, it's worse than you think. We're already at the mercy of an invasion of the Canadians, because what's so insidious is the Canadians look just like us.
Yeah, exactly.
They can infiltrate, and we don't even know.
If they haven't you seen the South Park movie?
Especially if they don't talk and don't say A or something. Then we don't know who they are. So it's insidious. I mean, the Mexicans are much easier because we can spot them.
Yeah.
And I don't know why people aren't more worried about the Canadians. It doesn't make any sense. No, actually, but seriously.
Well, we do have a government that, you know, if the Canadians really could ever take over America, it would have to be a coup d'etat, and then we have a giant empire for them to control. So
yes,
in a way,
you know,
we are kind of setting ourselves up for, you know, their subterfuge.
You know, for what it's worth, it's an unappreciated fact that the Articles of Confederation explicitly invited Canada to join the Confederation.
Oh, yeah?
Yes, it's right in there, very early on in the Articles. Of course, it's short, so everything's early in the Articles. But yes, it's right there. The Canadians, if they wish, they could become a member of the Confederation. So I think we should, you know, launch a movement to bring back the Articles of Confederation and then invite Canada.
Yeah, that'd be a good start.
To join. That's my personal project.
But again, though, no. Back to the serious question, though.
Okay.
Who would protect us without the Pentagon?
Well, that's. I have to laugh, and anybody who's paying attention should have to laugh. Who would protect us without the Pentagon? Who's protecting us from the Pentagon?
Yeah.
Who's protecting us with the Pentagon?
Which was, of course, what we've been talking about the entire first part of the show today.
Yeah. Look, as has been pointed out before, I'm hardly going to take credit for this. The Pentagon couldn't protect its own headquarters on September 11th. So what? This is a joke, right?
Yeah, don't go confusing Armistice Day with a Chinese holiday now.
Is this candid camera?
Yeah, you're busted.
So, make it a little more serious, but just a little, I think the case is stronger than ever for a non-state approach to defense. I mean, when I say stronger than ever, it's always strong, but I mean, as far as it being plausible to regular people who haven't thought much about this, I think it's now is the time we can make the most persuasive case. Because look what's going on. Looking at it from the eyes of the establishment, they say the biggest threat is what? International terrorism, right? Al-Qaeda.
Yeah, and Iran.
Well, and Iran too. But terrorism seems to be number one. You know, who can tell?
Well, and those are all the same thing anyway. So.
Okay, so terrorism by nature is extremely decentralized, entrepreneurial, flexible. You don't know where it's going to show up. You don't know what people are going to think of. You know, they're not marching in formation. They don't have divisions marching in formation and uniforms. That's what's considered so dangerous about it. Anybody can call themselves Al-Qaeda. You know, I'm waiting one of these days for some couple of guys or one guy pulls off a really sloppy, shoddy incident somewhere, and then, you know, he claims he's Al-Qaeda, and then next thing we read is the Al-Qaeda attorney is suing them to get them to stop saying that it was Al-Qaeda because they're, you know, they're defaming their defaming them because it was such a shoddy job. You know, they have a reputation to keep. So, but what the, you know, there's no copyright, right? Any, there's no trademark in Al-Qaeda. Anybody can say they're Al-Qaeda.
Yeah, not so, yet.
So if we, if we're really concerned about protecting ourselves from this, and I agree with, who is it, John Mueller, is that how he says his name?
Yeah, from the University of Chicago.
He wrote the book Overblown. Mm-hmm. You know, I tend to think that's right. But let's grant to the other side that it is a big menacing thing. Then we need precisely a decentralized, entrepreneurial, flexible approach to defense. And the last entity in the world to deliver that is the U.S. government, a big plodding dinosaur of a bureaucracy, which so-called terrorists could run rings around if they want to.
Yeah, but what about the Russians and the Chinese? You know, it's still 1975 around here.
Well, look, if you want to keep the Pentagon around for the Russians and the Chinese, fine, but let's take them off the terrorist watch because they're positively dangerous to us. And, you know, let's decentralize. Let's look, people who have expensive assets have an interest in protecting them from people who want to put plant bombs or whatever. So let's tell shopping malls and people who operate plants of various, you know, the various kinds, you're in charge of your own security. You have the most direct interest in it. You have the local knowledge, and you have the flexibility. You don't have to look to us. You take care of it, and then they'll take care of it because they have the huge, you know, the biggest interest in it.
Yeah. Well, now what about the Navy? Because the Navy secures free trade all around the world, Sheldon.
Well, I would sell the Navy. I would break it up. Look, I don't want the government to be the world's policeman. I know there are people who are advocates of empire, and they put a new gloss on it, that they want an empire that would be, you know, simply keep the trade lanes open and be the good cop. The problem is you can't trust the government to do that. It's going to do all the bad things. It's going to meddle, and it's going to, you know, it's just going to get into mischief. It's going to draw us into mischief. It's going to kill foreigners. It's going to bleed the taxpayers. That's going to, and Americans will end up getting killed too, and stimulating terrorism. So it's, you know, it's, I don't see, we're not getting any value for it, and it's costing us a huge amount of money. We'll find other ways to, you know, privately to protect sea lanes. I mean, the people that have an interest in trade will have an interest in protecting their ships.
Interesting to me that Dick Cheney in the 1990s actually went overseas. This is the cardinal sin, of course. Went overseas, and I guess it was Australia, so that only kind of counts as a foreign country. No offense, Tim, and the rest of y'all out there. But he went to Australia to complain about Bill Clinton's sanctions against Iran, and he was speaking as the CEO of Halliburton, and he was saying, come on, the Persians are reasonable people. Let us do business here. We ought to be going the other way from, instead of more sanctions, less, and get some things done. And then, lo and behold, just a couple years later, he becomes vice president, and he has the entire military at his disposal, and he's ready to regime change and occupy the entire Middle East, starting, of course, with Iraq. But as he admits now, he was the strongest voice inside the administration pushing for war against Iran.
Right, and, you know, as Madeleine Albright said, what's the point of having all these weapons if you never get to use them?
Right. She really did say that, too. Y'all can Google it.
She said it it was directed at Colin Powell, I believe, who was a bit dovish, at least in a relative sense, at that particular meeting. And that's right. She did say that. She also said it was worth, you know, killing all these Iraqi children. I forget who it was. I think it was Alex Coburn or somebody who, after 9/11, said he would love. Was it Alex Coburn? He wanted to drag her over to the hole where the Trade Center used to be. You know, hold her face down into the hole and say, is this worth it?
Yeah.
That's what she needed. Of course,
I don't know if that was Alex Coburn. That sounds like something he would write.
Yeah.
And
well,
it sounds like a lot of fun to do. I'd still like to see that. You know, there's still nothing but a hole there, so why not?
Yeah, that's right. And she's a big celebrity, of course.
Yeah, of course. Well, she's got these really nice brooches. And apparently, I mean, I read one New York Times story that was entirely about her brooches. And so I'm pretty sure, you know, it was also an important focus of Jon Stewart when she was on the show last, I think. So
yeah, I mean, he has her on a lot.
She's like the hypno-toad or something with those brooches. She just puts everybody in a trance.
He's so deferential to her. He doesn't ever bring up these remarks to her and say, you know, what were you thinking when you said this? But my attitude toward the American defense...
Well, by the way, she's actually apologized for saying it, and it's funny because she's apologized for saying it a few different times, including to Amy Goodman, and every time that she's apologized for saying it, all she ever says is, well, you know, I'm really sorry it came out that way and that your feelings were hurt by it or something like that. One of those complete non-apology apologies.
When her memoir...
By the way, I'm still glad that 500,000 kids are dead, she says, and spits on the floor, you know?
Exactly. And when her memoir came out, where she issued, maybe, I don't know if that was the first one, but it was in, you know, in print, I did an article in FFF's, you know, periodical, the Freedom Daily, and, on that. And I can't remember exactly what she said. I haven't read that in a while, but I took it apart, and it was, it was not a real apology.
All right.
Like,
so,
I shouldn't have said that on TV, or it came out wrong. You're right. But she didn't take it back.
Yeah.
My attitude toward the American defense establishment is sort of like that old line about lawyers. If we didn't have it, we wouldn't need it. That's why I say it. I mean, it gets us into the problems it then claims it's saving us from, which is very difficult.
Yeah.
Right?
Well, and it's clear that it causes far more violence than it prevents, although I guess a lot of Americans would just assume the premise that, well, it's violence against somebody else, not us, and it's what keeps us having a more or less stable society here, so go ahead with it. That's basically the consensus in the society, right?
I like the approach to defense. I mean, it's a serious question, okay? There could be bad guys out there. What do we do? Jeff Hummel, who has written in this in a few different places, who's a historian and economist at San Jose State, has a very good approach to this, and he points out that protecting ourselves from foreign states is really a subset from protecting ourselves from the state in general. I mean, we have a need to protect ourselves from the American state. The American state could be doing much worse things to us than it's doing. I mean, as bad as a lot of the things are, it could be worse, right? I mean,
In
World War I, they put Eugene Debs in prison, or they sentenced him. He didn't serve because a Republican let him out. 10 years, right? For what? For giving a speech, I think, criticizing the draft. Or U.S. entry into the war.
It was a clear and present danger, like fire in a crowded theater, they said.
Okay, today they wouldn't be able to do that today. Now, that's not because they became good and they love freedom now. I mean, the people running things. It's because, and I don't think we have a full explanation for this, but they don't think they can get away with it. They couldn't get away with it. Gosh, if Cheney and Bush didn't try it, they must really believe they couldn't get away with that. And
even Bush did not demand that the governors put National Guard troops at the airports after September 11th and stuff like that. It was pretty clear. I actually remember breathing a sigh of relief that, you know, they could have gone much farther with the whole continuity of government thing that they have there.
So there's a line they realize they can't cross. Now, what creates and enforces that line? It's certainly not guns. We don't have enough guns to protect ourselves from the government if the government was going to start jailing anti-war critics. It's an ideological barrier. This is Hummel's point. It's ideology, ultimately, that protects us. Ideas, he says, rules the world. This is almost a direct quote. Ideas rule the world, not force, because ideas determine what direction people point their guns. So ultimately, it's ideas, not force. And it's ideas that keep the government as contained as it is today. In other words, keeping it from doing more. Now, among the ideological forces that protect us from, say, these violations of free speech. I mean, I can get up and make a speech against the Afghan war, and chances of my getting arrested, it's not going to happen. What's saving me? Well, the ACLU, in part, is saving me. They know that the ACLU and other civil libertarians will spring into action if they were to attempt anything like this. The ACLU doesn't have any guns, and yet the ACLU, I mean, to use them as a symbol, is protecting all of us from government violations of free speech. They're doing it nonviolently. Who says nonviolent defense can't work? There's an example of it.
They would say, well, forget that. The judges are force. And that's what the ACLU does, is they go to the judge and they say, judge, you have a monopoly in this case. Tell the government no. And that's the only reason they get their way.
Yeah, but they often, look at all the times they don't. You can't look at them. It's like the unseen in Bastiat. Look at the times they don't go to court because the government didn't do anything. Or in other words, the government didn't attempt to stop them from speaking. I mean, look, there's a lot of anti-war activity going on the internet and other places, and the government is not trying to stop it. I think they know that there would be an uproar. So they're being deterred through nonviolent institutions. ACLU being an obvious example, but it's not just that. And similarly, gun rights organizations keep the government from doing even more than it does on guns. And in a lot of states, of course, they're permitting carry and concealed carry and stuff like that. Or, you know, why hasn't the federal government done more? Because there still is this nonviolent protection from unarmed institutions, you know, various organizations. I hate to mention the NRA because it's kind of the weakest of them all, but it's in that constellation of organizations. So what I'm getting at is Hummel's point that it's ultimately ideology that keeps governments from attacking us. And so the same thing would be true of foreign governments. The same methods we need to keep our government at bay would also be used to keep foreign governments at bay. It would be we would be making it undesirable for anybody to try to invade us because of nonviolent resistance and, you know, all the rest. That's what ultimately would protect us. The government is not a good protector. That would be a better protector. Now, you can find examples, of course, where governments, societies with either no state or very, you know, minimal states were overrun by other governments. But you can also find countries that had governments that were overrun. So governments aren't any better protection. There's no guarantees in life. But at least you don't have a homegrown so-called defense establishment, which is creating the very problems you thought it was there to prevent.
Yeah. Well, and the other thing is, too, is we got to recognize that on the earth that we live in, or on, or whichever, I guess you could live underground, the thing is that there is no combination of powers that could invade this country. If Europe, Russia, and China all work together, how many troop ships would they have to make? How many people would they have to give up and put on those ships and try to cross the Pacific Ocean and land in California, where everybody's got automatic weapons? That everybody does, you know, not forget the cops. I mean, they're armed to the teeth. But, you know, nobody could ever invade the United States of America. The only thing anybody could ever do to America would be to just drop hydrogen bombs all over the thing, which would make it not worth occupying in the first place. And really, the only way that that would ever happen, other than some fluke, which, you know, there have been close calls and whatever, but other than some fluke, really that would only happen if, say, for example, the Russians or the Chinese were trying to defend their country from ours. It's much more likely our government would be the one starting any war on that level.
Well, we are, as we're constantly reminded by the pundits and others, the you know, the sole superpower, and that creates an arrogance and an ability to you know, to feel like American exceptionalism, right? The rules are different for us, and so we can do what we want, but don't no one else better try it, or else, you know, there'll be hell to pay. The concern about nukes, which of course are, you know, people are now worried about suitcase bombs and stuff like that, it's becoming cheaper and smaller. That all goes to, I think, to my argument that what we need is as decentralized and entrepreneurial form of defense as possible, and you're not going to get that out of the state. The state's a big plodding, you know, Dilbert-like bureaucracy with a bunch of pointy hair people, guys, you know, making decisions when they don't really know what they're doing.
Yeah.
And information is imperfect. It's not just imperfect, but I mean, it's incomplete. It, you know, it gets filtered up in an edited, shaded way to make the you know, each level look better to the boss above. And you can't trust it. It's a bureaucracy. And it's got all the problems that Mises and Bill Niskanen and public choice people have written about. Bureaucracies are fatally flawed. And why do we want to, you know, of all things, okay, post office, I want the post office, you know, privatized, and I want competition. But of all the things that we're turning over to a bureaucracy, the worst thing, it seemed to me, would be defense, because that's where it really gets dangerous.
All right, well, now, so let's take it to a smaller scale in the local county sheriff's department. If you want private property anarchism, how's that supposed to work where you don't have a local police force? Because this is where people, you know, think back to before you were an anarchist. Boy, what are you talking about now? Abolishing all cops everywhere and whatever. This is fantasy land, utopianism, or something like that. How's this supposed to work?
Well, of course, it isn't abolishing cops. It's not, I'm speaking for myself, and of course, I know many people who would generally take the same philosophical approach as me. It's not this idea that once we get rid of the state, everybody will become nice, so we can throw away our guns and not have police, and you know, because everybody will be nice and wonderful and in some big commune. That's not what we're talking about. We're talking about simply that the functions, traditional functions of government, the traditional so-called legitimate functions of government, like police, would be much better handled in the private sector. You know, I heard a lecture recently by Brian Kaplan, who likes to point out that there are more private cops in the country than government cops. And one thing that tells us is that people are dissatisfied with the government cops. I mean, why are they hiring private cops for all kinds of things, malls and, you know, other...
Yeah, but there used to be bad old days of Pinkerton thugs, and we don't just want a bunch of private Blackwater armies running around acting like little governments, do we?
But they weren't acting on their own, were they? The government was calling them in to break up strikes and things. That wasn't freelance. Was that freelance stuff, or was that the companies calling them?
Well, I'm sure in some cases the companies were calling them, but then, of course, you have the company calling the governor, and then the governor calls them. Of course, John Rockefeller Jr. was responsible for the massacre at Ludlow, California. That was his call. And I'm not sure, though, where the politicians were in the chain of command.
Right. Well, look, they can't commit crimes. First of all, people can defend themselves against that. They won't have the aura of the state on their side, because by hypothesis, there wouldn't be one. So they would just be recognized as thugs. See, what people tend to forget in these conversations is that there's a whole society is a good deal of a good part of what society is. And Thomas Paine recognizes, if you read The Rights of Man, most of what society is informal custom that has just grown up over the ages, that is embedded in people's behavior and thinking. And if you took away the police, most people aren't going to commit crimes, right? I mean, suddenly the police just disappeared one day, most people are not going to say, "Hey, no cops, let's go out and rob banks and kill and rape." And that's not true.
Yeah, most riots are responses to cops anyway. Everybody knows that.
So when we can identify something as a society, that already implies that there's some sort of order and ongoing understood custom regarding how you deal with people, and those things tend to be what we think of as libertarian, right? I don't touch your stuff without permission. You don't touch my stuff without permission. I don't hit you. The stuff you learn as a kid, right? Don't hit. Don't take the kids' things without permission. And don't lie. Keep your promises. Keep your contracts. Societies discover those rules pretty readily, and they become embedded. Now, governments have come along when they conquer some place. They then codified these rules and often distorted them and made sure the king would get, you know, the fine when there was an offense rather than just let it be restitution to the wrong person. The king had to get his cut. It suddenly became breaching the king's peace, right? It wasn't A harm B, so A better pay B. It was now the king is a party to it now on behalf of everybody else. So it didn't come along and write the rules, no murder, thou shalt not murder, thou shalt not steal. It didn't write those rules. It realized that people were already abiding by those, and so it formalized them and said, "Hey, we're here to enforce them." So it was just a way of grafting itself on to an already existing society. And the early, liberals, classical liberals, understood this. Like I said, you can find it in Paine. There's a great quote in Paine. I don't have it at my fingertips, but you can find it early on in I'm pretty sure The Rights of Man, where he talks about the greater part of society has nothing to do with government. Now he wasn't an anarchist. He still wanted some minimal state, but the point is he recognized that government is not the motor of a society. That's self, it's organic, it's emergent, it's self-generating. And so a lot of these problems don't look quite as formidable, the problems that you mentioned, who's going to provide police at the local level, when you realize that. It's only when you see everything as top-down that then you think, well, oh my gosh, how can you take away the state, and then there's nothing. There's no glue holding us all together.
Yeah, that's really. You take away the state, you just take away the baton that everybody takes turns beating each other over the head with. That's the thing that people fight about more than anything else. Like the culture war in the schools. Are we going to brainwash all the kids into being secular, liberal, commie, pinko types, or are we going to brainwash them into all being a bunch of Pat Robertson following, born-again Bible thumpers? And so whoever wins the fight at the superintendent's meeting or whatever gets to force their way on everybody else's kid instead of just letting everybody go to school where they feel like. Well, it would seem to be the obvious answer to something like that, but anyway.
Well, and look, when people, if you propose this idea that we're talking about to people who haven't thought much about it, they're immediately thinking of the inner cities and they say, oh my gosh, the place will go to hell. But who produced the conditions? To begin with.
Yeah, and who's going to keep them there so they don't come here?
Who gave us the drug war? Who gave us the rotten schools? Who gave us the various laws that keep people from climbing out of poverty or make it very, very much more difficult than it would be? Minimum wage laws and things like that. In other words, the thing you're asking that they'd be asking to be to protect us, the very thing they're asking protection of, is the thing that gave us what they think they need protecting from.
All right, that's it. We're all out of time. Thanks very much. You got it.
My pleasure.
You nailed it. All right, everybody, that's Sheldon Richman. He is the editor of The Freeman. He's a fellow at the Future Freedom Foundation. That's fff.org. His website is sheldonrichman.com.